Join the conversation at everydaynovelist.com. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find the host at J.D. Sawyer on Minds.com, or hit him up at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you. Support this podcast and keep us going. Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 817.
Today, Dan asks,
"You have the most fantastic instinct for story I have ever seen. We've known each other for 26 years now. 25 or 26 years. And from literally the very first time we met, you have displayed an unfailing instinct for story logic and for dramatic tension to the point where I've never sat with you but once or twice in all those years through a novel, or because we sometimes read the same novels to bounce off each other, or through a movie or whatnot, where you couldn't unfailingly predict the important points of the outcome from the first act. I have always been astounded by this. It makes me very, very lucky to have you as my story editor, because you have such a great instinct for story. But I would love to know how you do that, where that comes from, and what you're hooking into, what you're seeing, anything that other writers would find useful. Because I don't have to actually know beforehand, because you read all my stories and you tell me when something doesn't work. And I know that if you think it doesn't work, it really won't work for anybody. Whereas if something does work for you, it will work for everybody. Or at least everybody whose tastes allow them to enjoy my fiction. What is it that you're seeing when you interact with a story?
I wish I could say that it was like training in classical literature or some wondrous thing like that, but really, some people don't know this, but English is not my first language. I learned English at about 4 or 5 and lost my first language. And I lived in a home with a non-native English speaker who spoke with a terrible accent. And still does.
Terrible, not as in unpleasant, but as in unintelligible.
Like, I can't understand my own mother anymore without really listening carefully, because she speaks a language that I don't speak and didn't maintain it for me. But the upshot of that is, I learned English through TV, for the most part, because I also grew up in Hawaii, and nobody in Hawaii speaks proper English. They do speak a proper language. I'm also a linguist, and so I will not tolerate anyone saying that pidgin is not a proper language, but it's not English. So I learned how to speak English by watching a whole lot of television, and I watched a whole lot of television in the 80s. It was a mix of genres, a lot of cartoons, a lot of myth, a lot of 80s drama like the A-Team and Magnum.
Canella and Belisario stuff, which of course is structurally perfect.
So I learned a lot through that, and I read a lot. And I think I just have embedded in me story structures, a lot of different story structures. And I can pick up the cues of whether something is playing out as a tragedy, as a comedy, as a hopeful mythology. And unless the authors are deliberately teasing something that they're not playing out.
They're playing a structural shadow game?
Yeah. Writing something that looks like it's going to be a romance and ending it as a tragedy. I pick up the cues of what structure it is, and from what a story sets up, you kind of guess where it can go. This makes me a great story editor, but it makes me shit as a writer. Because I write something and I see all the possibilities, and then I get choice paralysis. I don't know what to do next because I can see all the different places it can get to. And in my opinion, the best writing is the stuff that surprises me on the way to its inevitable conclusion. You know where it's going to end, but how it gets there is the fun part. And I really love it when something surprises me multiple times on the way from point A to point B. And
especially since you're someone who's very hard to surprise.
You manage to do it. Gail does it. The show Lucifer manages to do it all the time. And that mostly in the journey of how it gets to where it's going, because you know where it's going. I knew from the first episode where it was going with its two main characters. But the journey is amazing, and based on the way they wrote the main character in the first season, you kind of know what things need to be resolved for that character. But I have no idea how they're going to deal with the character of God in the next season, but it was inevitable that he show up, and that he play a major role. And that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. You know where it has to be going, and you know, when I do story editing for you, a lot of what I do is I will say, well, I'm expecting this here, like the Wolf of Venus. There is a point in the story where you kill off one of the main characters, and I said, that character's not supposed to die. That character can't die, because this character needs to play a role in the finishing.
And actually, I said, no, he's gone. He's dead. He needs to die here. And then several chapters later...
And then several chapters later, you said, wait, this needs this character here.
The experience was several chapters later, he showed up anyway, goddammit.
And in that case, it wasn't that the character needed to die, but that the main character needed to experience a loss. And the loss needed to motivate something, but the character that was lost wasn't supposed to die. And I wish I knew how I knew all this, but I'm just picking up on cues, and I think I overcompensated for not being a native speaker, and I was always trying to catch up. So I'm very, very steeped in the Western literary tradition.
But not just the Western literary tradition. You are also really steeped in your home culture's tradition, too. All that anime and...
Kind of. Anime, at least in the 70s and 80s, came from a period of mutual borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that started with the samurai and Western movies kept trading back and forth, where Westerns were borrowing entire plots from a classic samurai story, Magnificent Seven. And samurai and kung fu movies were borrowing from the Western traditions. Anime from that era was largely part of this back and forth. So it was this mixture of Japanese and East Asian sensibilities and Western storytelling structure.
But only kind of, because, I mean, like, Star Blazers and Gatchaman, which were two of your favorites, very much built around the Nakamo and that whole thing that I talked about in the episode on non-Western storytelling. So it was like the character structure was Japanese.
Yes, and that's kind of what I'm driving at. It shared a lot with Western comic book story.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about
that. It borrowed from Western pulp traditions, but the character arcs were very Asian. And I grew up with Japanese fables, and fables in every tradition are a completely different kind of story than rest of the fiction in the culture, because fables are a moral teaching tool for children, and it communicates the values of a culture, and grim fairy tales are very different from Shakespeare and...
Like Hansel and Gretel is about how to avoid, and The Big Bad Wolf are both how to avoid pedophiles.
Mm-hmm. And so I don't feel like I grew up steeped in Eastern storytelling. I learned Eastern moral values from children's stories, but that was the only kind of Japanese stories that I really absorbed. I've never read a Japanese novel, for instance. For one thing, I don't read Japanese, and it's really hard to get good translations.
And Asian American literature that's written in English is largely Chinese, particularly Cantonese and Mandarin cultural traditions. Like Amy Tan and whatnot.
Right, and a lot of the Chinese-American fiction that I've read feels a lot like Latin American.
The magical realism thing?
Yes, thank you. I used to know that term.
You have read a lot of Latin American fiction.
Yes. Yes, I love how weird magical realism is. But it doesn't follow the logic of the rest of Western storytelling.
Right, because it's a fusion of Western and like Aztec and Mayan story traditions.
Right. And Asian American fiction is a similar fusion of Western and Eastern traditions, rather than being either Western with Asian characters or purely Asian, written in English, right? So I think I just overcompensated for the feeling of being an outsider by totally absorbing Western fiction.
So the upshot was that you laid down story structure with your language acquisition, which most people don't, at least not as directly.
I think most people do. I really do. You know, you grow up reading, hearing, watching stories, and so you get an internal sense of what is appropriate. And I think that for me, I was deliberately trying to learn it at an early age to not feel like an outsider.
Interesting. So you were kind of a 5-year-old literary scholar without really knowing it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Also, I was a loner kid, so.
So what's the upshot as far as story editing? I mean, you're really, really damn good with story editing. And I don't think it's just me that you've story edited for either. I think you've done it for the occasional other person as well. What's the process and what should people look for in a story editor, or what should they look to learn for themselves so they have a better chance of constructing stories that don't need major restructuring at the proofreading and revision phase?
I think first and foremost is to have a story editor that enjoys the type of story you think you were trying to tell, whether it's pulp or romance or thriller or whatever, because they need to understand the genre expectations. Someone who's well-read in a variety of genres and a wide time period. You don't want someone who only reads a certain time period, whether that's recent, the last 5 years, last 10 years, or only reads classics, because their expectations of how a story should go is going to be limited by what they read. You want someone who enjoys the type of fiction that you're writing, but has read enough of a wide variety of story types from story eras that they will have an instinct for what works.
Especially if you're wanting to surprise your readers and not just knock off what's currently fashionable.
Yes. You don't want someone who's going to want you to imitate their favorite story. Partly because if they're limited to one time period or even one genre, they're going to lean towards imitating what worked in something else. I see this a lot and going to talk about Lucifer because I'm a personal fan of that. But I hear a lot from fans of Supernatural who keep putting expectations on the way the story of Lucifer is going to turn out based on what happened and who the angels are in Supernatural, or who are pulling from Dogma.
Which itself was influenced by Neil Gaiman, who is the author of the story that Lucifer is based on.
Right. They're putting on expectations from another related thing, but putting it on a story that's actually drawing from multiple other sources and multiple backgrounds and not on this other contemporary thing. So there's less to draw from if you're only comparing to something similar in a similar genre from this time period. And you limit expectations and your story options if you're only comparing to contemporary. What you want from a story editor is someone who can read halfway through the story and have expectations that are based on the story you're telling. That's the key. To be a good story editor, you need to pull from the cues that the writer is giving. Some will be conscious, some will be unconscious or subconscious. And the role of a story editor is to find the cues that you've laid in, or the clues you've laid in, without even knowing, and telling you, based on this, 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 and this, this is what's going to happen.
Well, yeah, but you don't want them telling you that as you're writing. You want them you want them telling you that after it's done.
Yes.
You know, so this doesn't work because this, this, and this are all present, and they're strongly pointing in this direction, and you haven't earned the direction you went.
Right. I think when you're seeing my story instinct, it's because I'm judging each story on its own.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm looking at a mystery, I look at the story that's being told, and I have in my head mystery fiction, but I'm not making my expectations of what happens next from other stories.
So you're spotting the intertextual cues.
Yes.
But if the story itself is not earning its own expectations that are in accord with the intertextual cues, then you don't let your victim, like me, get away with going on intertextuality alone.
Yeah.
That's kind of important.
And I'm not making expectations of what the story is going to be based on what I want it to be, but only based on the story itself.
So that's an important thing. So you actually want the story to be different and sort of self-sufficient, rather than wanting it to be something else that you already like.
Yeah, but I want a story to earn its ending, and I want it to be of a piece with itself.
So one of the important things in the way that you approach then is the intertextuality is a bonus that only enhances what the story does on its own. It can't substitute for
it.
What advice would you give to authors who can't afford a story editor or who aren't lucky enough to know where you sleep? So they have to kind of go out on their own.
Read your stories as a reader. And when you're reading the story, try to put in as much distance from your story that you can read it as a reader. Ask yourself, what would you expect from this story? If you didn't know what was going to happen to your characters, what would you expect to happen at this point?
And like write it down as you go?
Yeah. And if you can't do that with your own work, and I know some authors can't.
A lot of authors can't. That's a skill that's very hard to acquire.
True. At least not in the time frame that they'll want to edit and produce their own work. You might have to shelve it for a year before you can read it as a reader. And that's not always practical. Get someone to read it that likes that genre, but can read your story on its own without telling you, oh, you should do this thing that this other author did in this other story.
So you want to select your beta readers from among people who will tell you what you have promised them, not
yes.
People who tell you what they want.
Yes.
And that's a subtle but important distinction.
Very. It's important because you want your stories to be accessible to someone who's new to the genre and has no expectations, but be satisfying to someone who's a fan of that genre.
Good advice. Thank you very, very much for being on the hot seat this time. I think this will be a useful episode for people. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.
Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.